As Ralph released him, Camusso went up into the air, rearing like an unbroken stallion, feeling the saddle and spur for the first time, whinnying wildly with horror, beating at his own loins with both hands. If Ralph had not caught him, Butso, in a shaking paralysis of mirth, might have fallen into the fire in the centre of the hut. Camusso had been gone almost 3 years. When Butso and the other Matabili had signed their contracts for a third period, Camusso alone had asked Bakela to Bala Isitupa to write off the contract as complete, and he had taken the road north back to Matabili land. Butso had missed him deeply. He had missed the spiked tongue and shrewd acerbic counsel. He had missed Camusso's intuitive understanding of the white man's ways of thinking, ways which Butso still found unfathomable. Even though Henshaw was his friend, had worked at Butso's shoulder for all those long years, though they had hawked and hunted together, dipped into the same baking of maize porridge, and drunk from the lip of the same beer pot, though Henshaw spoke his language so easily that sitting in the darkness when the fire had burned down to embers, it might have been a young Matabili buck talking, so faithfully did Henshaw echo the deep cadence of the north, so complete was his command of the colloquial, so poetic the imagery he used. Yet Henshaw would never be Matabili, as Camusso was Matabili. Could never be brother as Camusso was. Had never shared the initiation rites with Butso as Camusso had. Had never formed the horns of the bull with him, as the impi closed for the kill. And had never driven the assegai deep and seen the bright blood fly, as Camusso had. Thus Butso was filled with joy when he heard the word. Camusso is amongst us again. Butso heard it first whispered by another Matabili as they formed a line at the gate of the security compound. Camusso comes as the king's man, they whispered around the watchfires, and there was respect, even fear, in their voices. Camusso wears the head ring now. Many young Matabili had come to work at Amagodi Kakulu, the big hole, these last few years, and each month more came down the long and weary road from the north, small bands of 10 or 20, sometimes only in pairs or threes, and occasionally even a man travelling alone. How many had reached Kimberley? There was nobody to keep a tally. 1,000, certainly. 2,000, perhaps. And each of them had been given the road southwards by the great black elephant. Each of them had the king's permission to journey beyond the borders of Matabili land, for without it they would have been speared to death by the bright assegais of the impis that guarded every road to and from the king's great kraal at Tabas in Dunas, the hills of the chiefs. Even in exile, these young Matabili formed a close-knit tribal association. Each newcomer from the north carried tidings, long messages from fathers and in Dunas, repeated verbatim with every nuance of the original. Just as every Matabili who left the diamond fields, whether he had worked out his 3-year contract, or was bored and homesick, or had fallen foul of the white man's complicated and senseless laws and was deserting, carried back with him messages and instructions that he had committed to the phenomenal memory of a people who did not have the written word. Now the word passed swiftly from Matabili to Matabili. Camusso is here. Camusso had never warranted such attention before. He had been one amongst 1,000, but now he had returned as the king's man, and they lowered their voices when they spoke his name. Butso looked for him each day, searching the faces on the high stagings and on the running skips. He lay sleepless on his mat beside the cooling watchfire, listening for Camusso's whisper in the darkness. He waited for many days and many nights, and then suddenly Camusso was there, stooping through the low entrance and greeting Butso. I see you, Butso, son of Gandang. Butso stifled his joy and replied calmly, I see you also, Camusso. And they made a place for Camusso in the circle, not pressing him too closely, giving him space, for now Camusso wore the simple black tiara upon his close-cropped pate, the badge of the counsellor, the Induna of the king of Matabili land. They called him Baba, a term of great respect, and even Butso clapped his hand softly in greeting, and passed him the beer pot. Only after Camusso had refreshed himself could Butso begin to ask the questions of home, disguising his eagerness behind measured tones and an expression of calm dignity. Camusa was no longer a youth. Neither of them were. The years had sped away, and they were both in the full flowering of their manhood. Camusa's features were sharper than the true Matabele of Zanzi blood, the old blood from Zululand, for his was mixed with Tswana, the less warlike but shrewd and cunning peoples of King Kama. Camusa's grandmother had been captured as a maiden still short of puberty by one of King Mzilikazi's raiding impis and taken to wife by the Induna who commanded her captors. From her, Camusa had inherited his mulberry black skin and the Egyptian slant of his eyes, the narrow nostrils and the thin and knowing twist of the lips. There were very few Matabele who could still trace their bloodlines back to the pure Zanzi, to the line of Chaka and Dingaan, the Zulus, the sons of heaven, and Batso was one of those. Yet it was Camusa who wore the ring of the Induna on his head now. In the time of Mzilikazi, a man would have the hoar frost of wisdom and age powdering his hair, and the cowtails bound upon his elbows and knees would proclaim his deeds in battle to the world before the king ordered him to take the Isikoko. Then his wives would plait and twist the headring into his own hair and cement it permanently into place with gum and clay and oxblood, a permanent halo of honour that entitled the wearer to his seat on the council of the Matabele nation. However, the old times were changing. More cunning than fierce, Lobengula, son of Mzilikazi, looked for cunning in those about him. Mzilikazi had been a warrior and lived by the white flash of the assegai. Lobengula, though he had blooded his spear, had never been a warrior, and he scorned the warrior's simpleness of thought and directness of action. As his father's greybeards faltered, he replaced them with men who thought as swiftly as the old ones had stabbed. He had no patience with the old men's preoccupation with a world that was passing, and he sought out the young ones with clear, fresh eyes, men who could see with him the dark clouds gathering on the southern borders like the soaring thunderheads of high summer. Men who could sense the change and terrible events which his wizards and his own divinations warned him would soon rush down upon him like the fires that sweep the papyrus beds of the Zambezi swamps at the end of the dry season. Lobengula, the great black elephant, whose very tread shakes the earth's foundations and whose voice splits the skies, was choosing young men with eyes to see and ears to hear. Thus Camusa now wore the Isikoko of the Induna, and as he spoke over the fire in his dry whisper, his slanted eyes black and bright as those of a mamba in the firelight, men listened, and listened with great attention. It was a measure of the gravity of the news he carried from the north that Camusa began the council, the Indaba, with a recital of the history of the Matabele nation. Each of them had heard it first with their mother's breast in their mouths, had drunk it in with her milk, but they listened now as avidly as then, reinforcing their memories so that when the time came they would be able to repeat it perfectly in each detail to their own children, that the story might never be lost. The history began with Mzilikazi, war chief of the impis of Zulu, warrior without peer, beloved comrade and trusted intimate of King Chaka himself. It told of the black sickness of King Chaka, driven mad with grief at the death of his mother Nandi, the sweet one. Chaka ordering the year of mourning in which no man might sow seed on pain of death, in which the milk from the cows must be thrown upon the earth on pain of death, in which no man might lie with his woman on pain of death. Mad Chaka brooded in his great hut and looked for cause to strike down all around him, even the most trusted, even the most beloved. So it was that Chaka's messengers came to Mzilikazi, the young war chieftain. They found him in the field with his impis about him, 5,000 of Zululand's bravest and finest, all of them still hot from battle, driving before them the spoils they had taken, the captured herds, the young and comely girls roped neck to neck. The king's messengers wore the long tail feathers of the stately blue cranes in their headdress, token of their solemn mission. The king accuses the Induna Mzilikazi, began the first messenger, and looked into his arrogant face. Mzilikazi knew that he looked upon the face of death. The king accuses Mzilikatsi of stealing the king's share of the spoils of war. Then the second messenger spoke, and his words were an echo of the king's black madness, so that the words of King Shaka stood in the air above Mzilikatsi's impis, the way that the vultures circle above the battlefields on wide and motionless pinions. If the sentence of death had been upon him alone, Mzilikatsi might have gone to his king and met it with courage and dignity. But his 5,000 fighting men were doomed also, and Mzilikatsi called them his children. So Mzilikatsi reached out and seized the king's messengers, and for a moment the earth seemed to lurch in its courses, for to touch these who wore the blue crane feathers was to touch the person of the king himself. With the razor edge of his assegai, Mzilikatsi slashed the blue feathers from their heads and threw them into the faces of the grovelling messengers. "That is my reply to Chaka, who is no longer my king." Thus began the great exodus towards the north, and seated over the watchfire, Kamuza, the king's man, related it all again. He told the battle honours of Mzilikatsi, the renegade. He told how Chaka sent his most famous impis after the fleeing 5,000, and how Mzilikatsi met them in the classic battle tactics of the Nguni, how he waited for them in the bad ground. Kamuza told how Mzilikatsi threw the horns of the bull around the impis of Chaka, and how his young men shouted, "Ngidla, I have eaten," as they drove in the steel. And the listeners in the dark hut murmured and moved restlessly, and their eyes shone and their spear hands twitched. When it was over, the survivors of Chaka's shattered impi came to Mzilikatsi and on their knees swore allegiance to him, to Mzilikatsi, who was no longer a renegade, but a little king. Kamuza told how the little king marched north with his swollen impi, and how he defeated other little kings and became a great king. Kamuza told how, after Shaka was murdered by his brothers, and Dingaan, the new leader of the Zulu nation, did not dare to send out more impis to pursue Mzilikatsi. So Mzilikatsi flourished, and like a ravaging lion he ate up the tribes. Their warriors swelled his fighting impis, and his Zanzi, the pure-blooded Zulu, bred upon the bellies of the captured maidens, and the Matabele became a nation, and Mzilikatsi became a black emperor whose domain overshadowed even that of Chaka. The men about the fire listened and felt their hearts swell with pride. Then Kamuza told how the Buni, the strange white men, crossed the river in their little wagons and outspanned upon the land that Mzilikatsi had won with the assegai. Then Mzilikatsi paraded his impis, and they danced with their war plumes aflutter and their long shields clashing as they passed before him. After he had reviewed the might of his nation, Mzilikatsi took the little ceremonial spear of his kingship, and he poised before his impis and then hurled the tor-like weapon towards the banks of the Garip River on which the white men had outspanned their wagons. They took them in the hour before dawn, at the time of the horns, when the horns of the cattle can first be seen against the lightning sky. The front ranks of racing black warriors received the first volley of the long muzzle-loading guns, absorbing it as though it were a handful of pebbles thrown into a stormy black sea. Then they had stabbed the bearded men as they worked frantically with powder horn and ramrod. They stabbed the white women as they ran from the wagons in their nightdresses, trying to carry the second gun to their men. They snatched the infants from their cradles on the wagon bed and dashed out their brains against the tall, steel-shod wheels of the wagons. Oh, it was a rare feast that they set for Mzilikatsi's chickens, the grotesque, naked-headed vultures. They believed it was an ending, but it was only a beginning, for the Matabele were about to learn of the persistence and the dour courage of these strange, pale white people. The next wave of white men came out of the south, and when they found the abandoned wagons and the jackal-chewed bones on the banks of the Garip, theirs was a fury such as the Matabele had never encountered in all their wars. So the Buni met the impis on the open ground, refusing to be drawn into the ravines and thorn scrub. They came in pitifully small squadrons on shaggy ponies to dismount and discharge their volleys in a thunder of blue powder smoke. Then they went up into the saddle to wheel away from under the wall of charging rawhide shields and to reload and circle back to let loose thunder again into the mass of half-naked bodies glistening with oil and sweat. The Buni built fortresses on the open plain, fortresses with their wagons' bodies, which they lashed wheel to wheel, and they let the impis come to die upon the wooden walls of the fortress, while their womenfolk stood close behind them to take the gun, while the barrel was still hot, and pass up the second gun, charged and primed. Then, when the impis drew back, mauled and shaken, the wagons uncoiled from their circle like a slow but deadly puff adder, and crawled forward towards the kraal of Mzilikazi. And the dreadful horsemen galloped ahead of them, firing and circling, firing and circling. Sadly, Mzilikazi counted his dead, and the price was too high. The red mud through which the iron-shod wheels churned was puddled with the blood of Zanzi, the blood of heaven. So he called his nation, and the herd-boys brought in the herds, and the women rolled the sleeping mats, and the little girls balanced the clay cooking pots upon their heads, and Mzilikazi put fire into his kraals, and led the Matabele nation away. A vast throng of people and animals were guarded by the depleted impis, while the white men on their sturdy ponies drove them and pointed them the way the sheepdog works the flock. Mzilikazi led them northwards until they crossed the great river into a new land. "Now the white birds are gathering again," Kamuza told the young men about the watchfire. "Each day they come up the road to Tabasindunas, and they bring their tawdry gifts and their little green bottles of madness. Their words are sweet as honey on the tongue, but they catch in the throat of those who try to swallow them, as though they were the green bile of the crocodile." "What is it they seek from the king?" Butso asked the question for all those who listened, and Kamuza shrugged. "This one asks for the right to hunt elephant and take the teeth. This one asks for the young girls to be sent to his wagon. Another wants to tell the nation of a strange white god that has three heads. Another wishes to dig a hole and look for the yellow iron. Yet another wishes to buy cattle. One says he wants only this, and another only that. But they want it all. These people are consumed by a hunger that can never be appeased. They burn with a thirst that can never be assuaged. They want everything they see, and even that is never enough for them. They take the very earth, but that is not enough, so they tear it open like a man tearing a child from their mother's womb. They take the rivers, and that is not enough, so they build walls across them and turn them into lakes. They ride after the elephant herds and shoot them down, not just one or two, not just the big bulls, but all of them, the breeding cows and the calves with ivory no longer than your finger. Everything they see they take. And they see everything, for they are always moving and searching and looking." "Lobangula must eat them up," Butso said. "He must eat them up as Mzilikazi, his father, would have eaten them." "How?" Kamuza smiled his thin, twisted smile. "Such wisdom from my brother. He recalls how Mzilikazi ate the white men on the banks of the Kharip and lost a land. Listen to Butso, my children. He counsels the king Lobangula to throw the war spear and loose his impis as Geshwayo, the king of Zulu, did at the Hill of the Little Hand. How many Englishmen did Geshwayo slay? There was no counting, for their red jackets lay upon one another like the snows of the Dragon Mountains when the sunset turns them to fire. And their blood fed the land, so that the grass still grows greener and thicker and sweeter upon the slopes of the Little Hand to this day. Oh, a fine killing, my children, a great and beautiful stabbing. And afterwards, Keshwayo paid for it with the spear of his kingship. He paid for it with his royal herds. He paid for it with the liver and heart of his young men, with the grassy hills of Zululand. For after the avengers had made the great slaughter at Ulundi, they took it all. They placed chains of iron upon Geshwayo's wrists and ankles, and they chained his indunas and his war captains and led them away. Now, Butso the wise would have you know what a good bargain King Geshwayo made, and he urges Lobangula to make the same bargain with these white men.